Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As concern about the state of our land, air, and water continues to grow, there's a belief that environmental stewardship is of interest to only certain communities, that there's a disconnect between the environmental movement and communities of color. My guest today has worked to correct that misconception and to open doors to institutions that haven't always been particularly welcoming to people of color. Angelou Azilo is the founder and CEO of the Greening Youth Foundation, which has educated children on the importance of environmental action and, more importantly, placed over 5,000 college-aged people of color in internships and agencies like the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, National Forest Service, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Azilo is a 2016 Ashoka Fellow and the author of Engage, Connect, Protect: Empowering Diverse Youth as Environmental Leaders. It's published by New Society. And she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Angelou Azilo, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
Your work is focused on bridging cultural and racial divides within the environmental movement and turning on communities of color into the environmental movement. Early on in your work, you recognized what you called the dangerous divide between people of color and the environment. How did you become aware of this?
Yeah, I mean, there is an example, actually, that I talk about in my book where I, working for the Trust for Public Land, doing land acquisition, I had to kind of go into different communities and knock on their doors to negotiate easements for what we now call our Beltline here in Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, I was going into communities of color, you know, because that's actually where the Beltline was going to be. So in going into some of these households, like one in particular that I speak of, you know, an older black woman answers the door and she looks like my grandmother. She obviously sees me as like a granddaughter type figure. She immediately trusts me and, like, you know, come in and, you know, oh, what do you need, baby? You know, that kind of thing. When I start talking to her about, you know, her land and how we're wanting to acquire an easement, you know, her whole thing was, oh, baby, whatever it is, you know, that you think I should do, you know, I'll do it. And I'm like, no, I need to negotiate, you know, against you. Like, this is something that is really important that I need you to, maybe there's somebody else. But my point is, you know, there's this level of trust that people of color have with each other, and there's no assumption that there's going to be something that, you know, we're trying to get something over on them. Whereas, you know, there's a disconnect because usually, and sometimes it's called environmental condescension. That's the way I see it, because it's like white people are typically talking, they're able to talk about things like conservation and melting snow caps and polar bears, but usually black people and Latinos, it's all about environmental justice. So, you know, there's a growing distance between people of color being associated with one thing and other people of color trusting that when it's coming from them versus white people being in this other camp. And I just think that it's very dangerous, especially, you know, people of color are often plagued and impacted more than others with climate change and other environmental degradation and issues happening in society. So we really have to work on kind of bridging that gap so that we're all working on all these issues collectively.
Communities of color traditionally have been on the margins of cities, oftentimes near the floodplain, on the floodplain, in places where there are likely to be more environmental impacts as climate change manifests itself in climate patterns and weather patterns.
It's true. It's definitely true. I mean, you know, there, whether it's the placement of sewage treatment plants or, you know, just various things that affect different communities as it relates to climate change, typically for communities of color, it's happening there, and they have less resources to respond to these emergency-type issues when they happen, and the response, you know, is actually lacking, you know, when coming to communities of color. So that's all the more reason. It's like double jeopardy, if you will. It's all the more reason for people of color to be really informed and aware of these environmental issues and how it affects them, and to vote accordingly and just to know, you know, what resources are available to them.
You talked about that disconnect between communities of color and the white community in how they view environmental issues. A lot of times within the white culture, it's about preserving natural lands. It's about preserving animal plant species. It's about, you know, looking at places even far off, rainforests, you know, glaciers, that sort of thing. Within communities of colors, it's about what you called environmental justice. I think people might need to know a little more about that. Is that we're talking about having clean drinking water to drink, having clean air in your community so that your children aren't suffering from asthma. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. I mean, that's true. I mean, there are things that, you know, plague and affect communities of color more, like we were talking about with these things, where they're located, because a lot of times they're in their communities. But, you know, but the notion that people of color aren't interested in the environment, even despite all of these, you know, things that are on the front, like social, you know, equity issues that are on the forefront of their minds, there's still so much evidence that shows that people of color are very much interested and involved in the environment in many different ways. It's just very intersectional. So, you know, you can't look at sustainability without looking at affordability. You know, you have to look at wealth and opportunity, access, equity, unemployment, education. All of that has to be factored in when talking about the environment. So, you know, as you said, typically white communities or white people are just focusing on, this is the notion that they're just focusing on or allowed to just focus on land conservation and water quality or, you know, polar bears or, you know, habitats and things like that. But the truth is, you know, communities of color are also those things they're aware of and they're connected to, but we just have to be more diligent with how those other issues are playing into their lives. So in other words, if young people aren't, they're not, you know, as we know, communities of color, the unemployment rates are like almost triple that of white young people. So it's very obvious and rational that if young people of color are concerned about, you know, jobs and livelihoods and just those fundamental needs, that it's going to be a little bit more difficult for them to jump into volunteering and doing things in the environmental sector. So that's why we at Greening Youth Foundation, we focus on weaving those two things together. So we provide trades and skills and internships and fellowship opportunities. So there are jobs associated with doing these this work within the environmental sector.
When you formed the Greening Youth Foundation, it was designed at first to just develop a curriculum that speaks to all people in building stewardship of the environment. I think that was one of your first steps, was developing a curriculum for children. Can you tell us how it went? Because I think you started in suburban Atlanta, and it worked one way.
I mean, it actually started, interestingly enough, with my youngest son's kindergarten class. It was me delivering an environmental lesson during Earth Day. I just kind of came into the classroom and kind of talked to them about reducing, reusing, recycling, and, you know, just kind of made it fun. And, you know, the response that I got from the kindergarten teachers and then, you know, other teachers like that were teaching environmental science was that the way that I presented the material made it really interesting and fun for the students so that it could be a great supplement to the curriculum that they were teaching in environmental science or what have you. So that was one of the things, that was kind of how we started in it. We started, as you said, it started in the suburb. It was in Snellville, Georgia. So the response was overwhelming. You know, the parents were volunteering, but of course it was predominantly white. So it wasn't necessarily, you know, it was great then, but a lot of the terms, you know, like alternative energy and composting and all of that, it actually wasn't the first time a lot of these young people were hearing those terms because in their communities, you know, one parent was home, you know, raising the child, you know, it was very a middle-class community. I kind of knew that I needed to reach students in Title I schools that maybe aren't getting that information. So in order for us to make progress in this area, I knew that I had to get to all children. Like, you know, if there's one demographic, one group of children that are aware of, you know, the importance of alternative energy and not using coal, but another group that doesn't even know what, you know, why it's important to bring a tote to the supermarket to recycle, then I don't feel that a lot of progress is being made. So it was really important for me to move that program to the inner city of Atlanta so that I can reach young people in Title I schools that aren't getting the bases because of that intersectional issues of social equity that are, that I mentioned earlier, that are plaguing their communities and that their parents are having to deal with. So that was kind of how the transition from being out in the suburbs of Georgia, how we moved it to Atlanta, and that's kind of when it really took off because we saw how much it was needed in communities of color.
But, of course, there, you mentioned in the book that she, when you first tried to transfer this program and this curriculum, it was really speaking to two different people.
Yes.
I imagine a woman with a guitar singing a folk song or something, you know, and the kids were going, what?
Yes, they were looking at us like we had three eyes. It was really kind of scary. We did have a panic moment. Ruth Kitchen, who is a white woman, you know, who was a neighbor that we kind of developed this curriculum, we did it together. But, you know, after that time when I saw the response that we were getting from these kids, you know, I knew that we had to go back to the drawing board and make it culturally relevant for them. And that's something that I include in the book is a chapter of, you know, the importance of having the material meet the young person where they are so that it resonates with them. So if that means including, you know, icons, celebrities, music, whatever it is, so that it really makes sense to them and where they are and in their community, then that's what you have to do. So that's hopefully what I did with some of the curriculum that I've included. And I kind of couch it in Kevin, who, you know, is experiencing asthma, not able to go outside and play basketball, and, you know, just kind of ways that we can bring the importance of air quality and, you know, asthma in communities of color, how to bring that message home.
I was also struck by something, you know, about getting kids into the outdoors. You know, this is one of the things you do. You take kids out to national parks, to natural areas. This is like, that's a big divide for some of those kids.
It is. It really is. I mean, there's so many things that affect, you know, young people of colors, family of colors, ability to get out to some of these, you know, amazing national parks. Actually, Mickey Fearn, who is the deputy director for the National Park Service, who's also an African-American man, he actually said that it was kind of cruel to bring these young people of color in the inner city out into these beautiful, iconic parks and just this one time and then bring them back. And it's like, okay, just wanted you to see that, but, you know, there's probably no way that you're going to get back out there. Mm. You know, and I kind of, we have that same philosophy at Green and Youth Foundation is that we want to provide pathways so that they're not these one-off experiences. And in fact, you know, we actually I did a workshop on at the National Recreation or Park Association, which is regional and local parks. So, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of work with them to, you know, hold up and emphasize the importance of the state parks, local parks, county parks, you know. So it's not just about these national iconic parks. You know, there are parks. Everybody deserves to have a great park in their community. So, you know, there is a connection that we want to make there as well.
Is there still a feeling of exclusivity in some of these locales that certain people are welcome, other people's maybe less so?
Yeah, there are. Unfortunately, as we approach 2020, you'd think that this was a topic that we wouldn't be discussing. But, you know, there really is still a lot of discrimination that goes on in these natural places and places that are maintained by taxpayer dollars. So we often say these are all of our parks, all of our forests, all of our refuges. But, you know, one of the things that we emphasize now with our partners is that, you know, we do all this training of our young people and our young adults of color to go on and do these internships in these national parks and forests and so forth. So they're prepared, you know, like we do a whole webinar on cultural awareness and culture shock and what you might encounter and how to deal with different situations. But then what started happening was that there wasn't training being done on the other side. So their direct supervisors, you know, the staff of these places, you know, the seasonals, all those folks weren't used to interacting with young adults of color. You know, so they were experiencing a lot of the problems were coming from the inside, and which was sending our interns running and, like, telling people on the way, which was totally undoing the work that we were doing. So now what we do is we do webinars and trainings for the staff of these places and organizations that we partner with, because we realize that there's generations and decades after decades of, you know, perhaps there just being this one prototype of who recreates or even works in these outdoor spaces. And we're shifting the paradigm of what that person looks like and, you know, what's the demographic of that person. But, you know, we understand now that, you know, this is going to take time. It's not something that happens overnight.
My guest today is Angelou Azilo. She is the founder and CEO of the Greening Youth Foundation and the author of Engage, Connect, Protect, Empowering Diverse Youth as Environmental Leaders. It's published by New Society. Well, let's talk a little bit about those internship programs. I think you started out working with the National Park Service, but now that's spread to the Forest Service, BLM, Bureau of Land Management, NOAA, in creating, again, this gets back to one of your beginning statements, which is that it's you're creating environmental stewards, but you're also creating employment paths, which creates more opportunities for people of color and communities of color. Can you talk about those internship programs? Was it difficult getting it started?
Yes, yes. Yeah, and you mentioned all the ones that we're now partnering with. I think the only one you didn't include was Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay.
Fish and Wildlife Service. But yeah, I mean, it has been an interesting road, I should say. So our first partner agency was the National Park Service, and I think our first project was a green project where we were working in the Intermountain region, and it was probably about 10 or so different national parks that we were working with there, including the Grand Canyon, and working with homeless inner city youth from Denver. So that's when we first started realizing that we were adding value to what was happening within the National Park Service, because these young people who live right there in Denver had never gone to any of these national parks that were literally right in their backyard. And that's something that we're finding with a lot of, so we have our flagship program is called our HBCUI program, which is Historically Black Colleges and Universities Internship Program. And that's where we pair HBCUs to national park sites across the country. And, you know, in a lot of cases, there has been no relationship between the two. So we're opening the eyes of these young people to career pathways that exist within the Park Service, and the staff within the Park Service are seeing that there is an incredible resource within these HBCUs. And actually, I include a list of these HBCUs. It's one of the appendices that's included in the book, because I thought it was very important for a lot of these mainstream organizations and schools to know that these tribal colleges are out there, Hispanic-serving institutions, as well as HBCUs are out there. And in order to really start being more inclusive and broadening the reach, we have to start collaborating and partnering. But as a result of doing this work now for close to 14 years, we place close to 500 interns a year on federal lands across the country. So we're really proud of that number, and not just because of their internship experience, but because of the ones that are actually going into the field as a result of that exposure. So I would say, you know, the number isn't huge, but of, you know, maybe the 5,000 or so that we've placed, I would say maybe about 15%, 10%, you know, is actually going into either working for a federal land management agency or working in the environmental field.
Yeah, that's close to 1,000 young people. Could you talk about recruiting those young people in college to even think about this? Was this something that was not on the radar at all when you first started?
Yeah, no, and that's a really important point that you just made there, because I think that insular recruiting is really one of the things that Dr. Dorsetta Taylor talks about. She's a sociologist from the University of Michigan. She talks about it in her Green 2.0 report that, you know, people tend in these organizations tend to hire themselves. They tend to hire people that look like them, have the same interests as they do. So that, in fact, affects what the numbers are, which is still a paltry 12 to 16% within, I think she surveyed maybe like 196 organizations within the environmental field, creating this green ceiling, if you will, or Green Insiders Club. So one of the things that we do at Green Youth Foundation is very intentional recruiting. So, you know, we go to the HBCUs, the tribal colleges, the Hispanic serving institutions, and actually share with them these opportunities. And as you kind of correctly stated, these career pathways aren't even really on their radar, you know. And as like what I shared in my story, you know, I probably would have gone into this field and not become an attorney had I known about it, you know, because I certainly had the interest, the love was there, the passion was there, but, you know, no one encouraged me to go into this field. So that's what I'm really hoping to do, and perhaps that's why, you know, that was kind of the impetus for Green Youth Foundation and why I founded it, is because I wanted other brown young people to understand that this was, in fact, a career pathway that they could pursue, and, in fact, that we really need them to pursue. With all these environmental issues that are plaguing our society today, we can't really be in a position where we're saying this group, but not this group. We really need everybody on deck.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned about how the environmental institutions themselves have to adapt to a more diverse population, to communities. Can you talk about adaptation? So, because, you know, every once in a while you see stories from the National Park Service, from some of these organizations that have been traditionally monoculture, having issues adapting to a diverse work population.
Yes. And I'd say it's been tough. You know, change is always a scary thing. So, you know, the way that we have been helping in this message of, in order to maintain relevant, you have to diversify. There's just no way around it. You know, with, you know, millennials and, you know, there's so much going on right now that it really limits an organization, a mission, a purpose, a group by having that monolithic view. And we think that at Green Youth Foundation, and in fact, it's proven that by starting with having interns or even fellows, you know, that is, you know, often a way that organizations could deal with and work with broadening their culture, you know, within these organizations. Obviously, you know, having staff, you know, I mean, there's many things that can be done, you know, but I do think that internships, fellowships are a good way to kind of start that process of really opening the door and broadening the workforce.
Well, sounds like you're doing some amazing work. Angelou Azilo, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich. Thank you.
Angelou Azilo is the founder and CEO of the Greening Youth Foundation and the author of Engage, Connect, Protect, Empowering Diverse Youth as Environmental Leaders. It's published by New Society. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Last month, the Tulsa theater community lost an important part of its foundation with the passing of David Cook, who was a University of Tulsa theater professor, trained a couple of generations worth of theatrical professionals during his four-decade tenure at the university. A memorial was held last weekend, and our commentator Barry Friedman has this remembrance.
David Cook and I arrived at the University of Tulsa in the fall of 1977. Elvis had just died. Jimmy Carter was president. George W. Bush was an alcoholic. And tuition at TU was about $2,800 total for the year with room and board. And in case you weren't nostalgic enough, Donald Trump was still married to Ivana and hadn't yet declared even his first bankruptcy. David Cook hated Trump, and I'm here to celebrate all of my former friend, including his politics. The first show Dave directed at TU was The Crucible by Arthur Miller, which had some incredible male roles, and he didn't cast me in any of them. The second show he directed was The Birds by Aristophanes, and this time he did cast me as a big, dumb bird who carried a club, wore a leopard skin skirt, and talked like Sylvester Stallone. Took me a long time to forgive Dave for that. When Dave got to TU Theater, he said theater students in Tulsa knew three plays, and it was his job to find out which three. I'm joking. I didn't know that many. But Dave insisted, and this was his gift, that acting, theater, was to be taken seriously. When he said the words, the play, you could hear his love for the art, the fidelity to the words and its history, the literature it came from, and the DNA of all that came before it, the whole shebang. That was the muse, if you were looking for one, the only one. He also parked wherever he damn well felt like it. For years, Dave parked on the ramp of the theater department technical shop. It was a ramp that was to be used exclusively for deliveries and the load-in and load-outs of shows. Others who tried parking there were ticketed. Some even had their cars towed, not Dave, who had more important things to do than spend time walking from the parking lot to the theater. He was saving theater in Tulsa. My second year, he directed Eugene O'Neill's The Emperor Jones, and he didn't cast me again, and I was furious, even though his decision not to cast me, a Jew from New York, in the role of an African-American Pullman porter who sets himself up as emperor of a Caribbean island, seems, in retrospect, pretty sound. It was the second play, though, where the friendship became indelible. It was The Diary of Anne Frank. Dave cast me as Otto Frank, the father. Now, there's a heart-wrenching scene at the end of the play where Otto goes back to the attic where his family was holed up for years after they're all murdered in concentration camps, and he reminisces about their lives and his love for them. It's a brutal monologue for an actor. And before we rehearsed it for the first time, Dave said to everyone, the actors and crew, to stop what they were doing and just listen. I went through the monologue, looked at Dave, who looked back at me, and said, the next time we do this will be opening night. We're not going to run through it again. He knew what it took out of me, and knew most importantly when the lines of a play are no longer just lines, but the breath of a human being. And on opening night, after the show, Dave, big, burly, his beard not yet gray, met me in the green room, shooed everyone away, thanked me, then grabbed and cupped my face and kissed me on the cheek. It was the best single review I've ever received. No words, just a kiss on the cheek. That kiss will stay with me. David Cook will stay with me. And one more thing. I passed the scene shop on the way to the studio today. Nobody was parked there.
Barry Friedman is a freelance writer and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. His most recent book is titled 4 Days and a Year Later, An Elegy. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.